I will call the Senate Rules Committee to order.
I hear his voice.
Is he out there?
I thought I heard his voice. Okay, that's not it.
Do we have any measures? Okay. We will start by opening a public hearing on SCR 14. Council.
Madam Chair and members, Senate Concurrent Resolution 14 acknowledges the 75th anniversary of Japanese American internment during World War II and recognizes February 19th as a day of remembrance. There are no amendments associated with this measure, and as well, fiscal and revenue paperwork indicates that there is no anticipated impact as a result of this legislation.
Okay, we have two of our colleagues here, Senator Mattis Anderson and Representative Clem. Like to come up and open this hearing for us.
So thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, and I represent District 21, which is here in Salem. And I also have the great honor and privilege to being married to a Senate staff person of longtime service, and Carol Suzuki, who's here. And it was really through her that I learned more about the Japanese internment. Honestly, as my former high school principal can tell you, there's only so many things that can be taught in high school history classes because there's lots of things to cover. And we had a librarian in Coos Bay who wrote a really great book about the internment, but I just really didn't know about it for some reason. Probably wasn't paying attention the day we talked about it in class, if at all. And when I married Carol, she told me that her family had been incarcerated, and I really was shocked to learn this. And so over the years, I've certainly learned a lot more, but it was through getting to know her dad, who didn't really like to talk about it much, but I saw lots of documents about the internment from her family history, that I became interested in this issue. And so we've had a number of things in the 10 years I've been here and probably before that, that did honor people and honor days and, called us to think about this more often. And this particular resolution that I'm really pleased that the Senate is taking the lead to get it moving so you could actually have something on the day of remembrance coming up and Min Yasui Day that we passed last session. And then when it gets to the House, we will take it up, but it will be potentially after some of the days have passed, just depending on legislative calendar. So this particular resolution, you'll have people in the audience who can really speak about what it was like. There's some folks who were in camps I see out here. I certainly have learned about it mostly through discussions with people that I've met in the legislative process and by reading things that Carol has kept from her dad's files and records over the year. I think most importantly, I think nobody agree. You're not going to find anybody defending internment anymore. I don't think that there's a debate about whether it was appropriate to imprison U.S. citizens like Carol's dad, who had never even been to Japan, who were born here. Her uncle was born in Metolius, Oregon, and served in the war fighting the Japanese, and yet his family was all incarcerated. So nobody defends it anymore. But the question is, are we at risk of running into these kind of problems again? And that's where I think it's important to remember the difference between people who hold U.S. citizenship, people who hold legal permanent residence and visas, and not forgetting that because of a drop of blood in their body, that these are Americans who shouldn't be treated like enemies or aliens because they happen to hold different ethnic backgrounds. They are entitled to all the legal rights of citizenship, and many of the Japanese had no ties in any way to Japan. They had, in fact, severed all ties to Japan and immigrated here with the hope of a dream. So then to be accused of potentially spying for Japan was a double insult because they had already walked away from Japan generations earlier. And so I should stop and let Senator Dembro talk because he obviously helped organize with Senator Mattis Anderson this bill, and we were chit-chatting on text about something else, and he asked if I was doing any kind of resolution, and I joined the bandwagon on the Senate resolution. So thanks for accommodating me over here in the Senate side.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator Dembro.
Okay, thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair. Michael Dembro, Senator for District 23, that's Northeast and Southeast Portland. And I'm very proud to bring you this resolution, which had its genesis. You know, I'm the Senate liaison to one of the governor's advocacy commissions, the one that deals with Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, OCAPIA. And at one of the meetings there, I learned that this February 19th, or 18th, 19th, is February 19th, is the 75th anniversary of this order. And, you know, it 75 years is that's a big anniversary. And it seemed really important for us as a legislature to recognize that. You know, in addition with, you know, all the debate that's going on about immigration now, and, you know, I remember hearing during the campaign when there was discussion of registries of various sorts, someone saying, it was actually a congressperson saying, well, we've done it before. We had a registry back in World War II. And it really struck me that, wow, there is a level of understanding of, it was a lot more than a registry that happened in World War II. And, you know, as Brian so eloquently just went through, people's lives were devastated by that. And subsequent analysis revealed that it was really unfounded, that, you know, there was no danger from the individuals that were registered and then subsequently incarcerated in camps. And, you know, if we can't learn from history, why do we learn anything? And so it seemed really important then to put this resolution together. I worked with the chair of OCAPIA, Mari Watanabe, who I think is probably going to speak to this. And, you know, with her, we gathered some existing resolutions that had been offered to Congress and used it as a basis to put together a resolution that I think really speaks to Oregon. We were initially just going to have it be a Senate resolution just for time purposes to get it through, but it looks like, you know, with grit and determination, we're able to make it a concurrent resolution and still have it done in time before the actual anniversary. So I'm really pleased about that. Anyway, be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Lori Montes Anderson. I represent East Multnomah County. And I had also introduced a resolution. The Japanese community in my district came to me and said, Lori, are you doing anything about the 75th anniversary of the Japanese internment? And I said, no, tell me about it. So I had introduced legislation also and then found out that Senator Dembro had also done it. So I had my LC, I hadn't sent it to publications yet. And so I asked Senator Dembro, are you really doing it? He said, yes. So I dropped my resolution and tagged on to his. So if you look in OLIS, there are two testimonies from Nancy Ochida and Roy Ochida. Can I have the first picture? This is the Ochida family, and I'm very, very close to Nancy Ochida. We were in first grade together and third grade together, but this is a photograph of the Ochida family in a tent. Jack is Nancy's father, and then Shizuko, his mother. They both now have passed away, but Nancy basically stated that Both her mother and father and all their brothers and sisters were born in the United States and were American citizens. Grandmother and her grandmother and grandfather had immigrated from Japan in about 1910. That's about the time when my grandparents immigrated to the United States. And they were all employed in the lumber, timber, and railroad building. And later they worked so hard and saved enough to establish a farm near Powell Valley Road in Gresham. 10 weeks, you know, after the outbreak of the war, on February 19th, President Roosevelt signed an executive order which gave the Secretary of War and the military commanders, to whom he delegated authority, the power to exclude persons of Japanese ancestry from designated areas in order to secure national defense objectives. The Uchida family was given about a week's notice to vacate their homes and businesses, to report at the Portland Assembly Center, which was the stockyards where cattle were sold for slaughter, and they were only allowed to take what they could carry. I'm going to tell you a little bit also of what Roy Uchida told me in his testimony, and that is also on OLIS. What they had to do was they had to sell or pack as much as they could in 6 days. And the 6 days is probably the worst thing, now this is his words, the worst thing a government could do to any American citizen. In our case, that's Roy's case, we had just got electric power, so the house was wired for electric lights and power outlets. We changed our wood kitchen stove for an electric range. We tossed out our ice box for a refrigerator. We put an electric motor on our gas engine Maytag washer, installed an electric motor water pump to replace our rope and bucket water system, all at great expense, only to be taken away at a stroke of a pen. We could not sell our new International Harvester tractor and the implements, so it was consigned to the dealer where we bought it. Hessels, that's a company in Gresham, did sell it a few months later after a hefty consignment fee. Our nearly new Chrysler sedan luckily was bought by our great Norwegian neighbor, the Nybergs, and they drove us to the assembly center rather than having the Army pick us up in a truck. They then stored our truck and many boxes of stuff in their barn. Unfortunately, mice and mold got into almost everything, but I am forever grateful to the Nybergs. The assembly center was a stinky place of horse stuff since we were in the horse barn. Room dividers were plywood on a wood floor with no ceilings or doors. Beds were bags of straw. One small restroom for each sex for hygiene. Picnic tables for meals if you can stand staying in line for food. We were there from April 42 to August 42, with August being one of the hottest on record, and boy, did it stink. And that was in Portland. Then came the ride to who knows where. Answer, Minidoka, Idaho, near Jerome, Twin Falls. It was hot and dusty in the summer, very cold in the winter, with single-wall construction barracks covered with black tar paper. And I do have a picture of that, but I wasn't able to put it on. It didn't show up as well. And the tar paper to seal out the weather, but could not keep out the dust in summer, nor the cold in winter, because of the half-inch space between the floorboards. We seven survived in a 20 by 25 room with seven folding canvas cots, a coal-fired pot-bellied stove, and slept on folding canvas cots. That's it, folks. There was strange European-type food that was served in a common dining hall after waiting in line. To shower, there was a line for one of six shower heads in one room. To wash or shave, wait for one of the six or eight basins in the other room. If you needed to go to the bathroom, you had to wait for one of the six commodes lined up on one wall, all without dividers or doors. Welcome to U.S. Army boot camp facilities of World War II. If we needed to wash our clothes, well, welcome to concrete twin tubs and your newly purchased scrub board. Good by painless back and smooth skin hands. Oh, soap? Wonder where where we can get some, or maybe the canteen three blocks away. Problem is, who's got any money unless you have a job working for the camp making $16 a month? Maybe you were a doctor, an MD, or a dentist, and then you were paid $20 a month. Or you could be picking spuds for 1 week on the outside, and you would be paid $100. I am happy and thankful for all those teachers that accepted a government job to teach us and were brave enough to live in the camp with us without fences. Only the military police that pointed their guns toward us had a fence-guarded compound. While basic necessities were provided for survival, believe me, when I say it was miserable, I am glad that I was not married or that I was a teenager of dating age. That must have been unbearable. With all of this stuff going on, many, though, volunteered for the military after they got out. I am forever thankful for the persons of Japanese ancestry that were in the internment camp that were doctors, dentists, nurses, teachers, caregivers, policemen, firefighters, mechanics, chefs, janitors, farmers, florists, artists, gymnasts, and everyone else that had a skill that made the internment camp feel like a true community, with or without government intervention. Roy went on also to send me some information that said when they got back into Gresham, there were signs saying no Japs allowed in their store. No Japs could eat in the particular restaurants. No Japs could shop in some of the stores. And so one nice little thing that he did say, after 5 years of being interned, there were friends that tried to help them out. Zimmerman's, we had a grocery store. Zimmerman's 12-mile store allowed them to buy food and merchandise. Mitzi Fauner, one of my best friends who was a public health nurse, her dad bought strawberry plants for Nancy's father so that he could start farming again. And then Roy also stated that he attended Gresham High. He said, you know, I knew your dad. And he said, and it makes me very sad, he said, that's where I met this great man named Bud Monas. Unbelievable how his words and manners thwarted many of the prejudice that was an everyday event for me while I walked the halls of Gresham High and tried to have a sack lunch. So there were people there that really cared about the Japanese when they came back to our community. But they had suffered so much. And the reason that many of them did not want to come today was they are shy. They are quiet. And it's a very painful experience for them, and they did not, they don't want to relive it. Now, these are Nancy's aunts and uncles. Go to the next slide, Tom. I want to show you. There's my third grade class. And you'll see Nancy in the first, second, third row on the very right. You'll see me in the second row, third from the left. But and then Steve Ando, but I'm not sure what descent he was. Then go to the next slide. These were my friends. Now, these were my best friends. And as you see, Priscilla Fernandez on the right, but she's Filipino. But then there's Nancy Ochita. Second from the right. These were my friends, and for them to have suffered so much, I am so happy that we are doing this resolution for those that were interned during World War II. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm going to have to leave if you have any questions. I just want to say thank you very much for giving this expedited attention so that we can hopefully get this out in time to recognize the anniversary before it happens.
We'll do our level best. Right, thank you. Okay, are there questions or comments for the remaining two? Okay, our next witness.
Madam Chair, if I might. There's one letter I just want to make sure you know about. He's not here. He's 92, but he did testify in a House committee a year ago, and it was remarkable. Homer Yasui, who is Min Yasui's youngest brother, he and one other Yasui, his older sister, is still alive. Everybody else has passed away. But in particular, he makes very poignant remarks that I think you'd like to see.
And that's on Ola's side.
Yes. It is. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, our next witnesses are Mari Watanabe and, let me see if I can get this, Chapon Silapasai Akimura. Was I close?
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair.
And they are always polite, and they always say that even if it wasn't polite. So I just find him, having
well,
been a principal.
Well, I'm very much forward to hearing you put your name on the record.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Ferrioli, and Senators Beyer, Boquist, and Roblin. I'm Mari Watanabe, Chair of the Oregon Commission on Asian and Pacific Islanders, also known as the acronym OCAPIA. Thank you for this historic opportunity to speak. As a third-generation Japanese-American whose grandparents, mother, father, aunts, and uncles were all incarcerated during World War II due to the Executive Order 9066, I am honored to be here to testify in support of the passage of this resolution. February 19, 2017 marks the 75th anniversary of the signing of this executive order by President Roosevelt, which led to the mass incarceration of 120,000 Japanese Americans because they looked like the enemy. 4,000 were from the Oregon Japanese American community who were first sent to the Portland Assembly Center, now called the Expo Center, and then to the Minidoka Incarceration Camp near Twin Falls, Idaho, or the Tule Lake Incarceration Camp in Northern California because of fear, racism, and war hysteria. Not only did they lose their homes, businesses, and property, they lost their civil rights as citizens of the United States. A young William S. Nato, a Portland native who became a revered business leader, told his Japanese-born parents that nothing would happen to their family after the bombing of Pearl Harbor because he had just learned about the Constitution in school. They were Americans, so they were safe. As we know, this was not to be so. Shortly after the bombing, the FBI took away my grandparents, as they did other Japanese leaders in the community in the middle of the night, to be held in Department of Justice incarceration camps without cause. Recognized in this resolution are some of the sacrifices these Japanese Americans. Recognized in this resolution are some of the sacrifices these Japanese Americans made to prove they were loyal Americans. And because of these sacrifices, the honors they received, such as the Congressional Gold Medal for the Japanese American veterans, which is the only Congressional Gold Medal on display in the Smithsonian out of over 157 medals awarded, and the Presidential Medal of Freedom for Minoru Yasui, the first and only Oregonian to receive this highest honor from the President of the United States, because he was not afraid to stand up for what he believed was the unconstitutionality of the military curfew. This resolution also recognizes the federal legislation that created the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. My family and thousands of other Japanese Americans did not deserve the harsh and unfair treatment they received because of their heritage, and neither do those we see today in our Muslim communities. This resolution will be a reminder that any executive order that seeks to call into question our rights because of our heritage is wrong. We all know we must not walk down the path of Executive Order 9066 again. With deep appreciation on behalf of OCAPIA to the sponsors of this resolution, as well as to you, we urge the passage of this resolution in remembrance that this day and every day, educating ourselves and others that this history must be learned and not repeated. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Ferrioli, and Senators Beyer, Boquist, and Roblin. My name is Chapon Silapasai Okamura. I am the chair-elect of the Oregon Commission on Asian Pacific Islander Affairs, known as OCAPIA. On my day job, I'm an immigration attorney, and I work quite a bit with our immigrant and refugee community. I'm also currently the past chair of Immigrant Refugee Community Organization. We wholeheartedly, OCAPIA and the community, support this resolution because we believe it is ethically and morally the right thing to do. My husband's family, the Okamuras,
Okay, just take your time.
My husband's family, the Okabers and the Watanabes, during the executive order 9066, their entire family were incarcerated and taken to Minidoka. My husband's family lost everything. Till this day, although Uncle Eugene, Aunt Roy, they hold the National Museum, they refuse to talk about what happened to our family. The trauma that my family has gone through resonates through every generation, from my in-laws to their parents to my parents. I myself am a refugee from war-torn Laos. My family escaped persecution because my dad fought on the side of the Americans. Through the kindness of the U.S. Office of Refugee Resettlement, we were given the opportunity to be in the U.S. Today, as we work with the community to help educate the community, there is a growing fear and trauma that the Executive Order 9066 will resurface. When the executive order by the president was put in place, our Muslim community and our immigrant community, in addition to our refugee community, felt instant impact. We had families who were denied U.S. citizens entry into the United States. We had green card holders who were stuck in secondary inspection for countless hours. We had visa waiver holders who could not get in. I was one of the attorneys at the Portland airport. I watched day after day assisting families in tears. One will never leave my mind. It was a legal permanent resident who was from Iraq. He was Muslim. I sat with his wife and their young daughter and their cousin, holding their hand because the father had to fly back to Iraq to get the birth certificate of his daughter so he could enroll her into school. He was stuck in secondary inspection for 6.5 hours. The family thought that he had signed a waiver to allow himself to be deported so that he would not be allowed back in. Rumors have spread far and wide. ICE was believed to have shown up at courthouses, airports, and hospitals. The ripple effect caused our families to not show up at airports. We had refugees that were stuck. We had injured families that would not go to the hospital. And we also had families who refused to go to court, victims of crime, to testify against their perpetrator. The executive order was a ripple effect. And this was exactly what we, in our families, have feared would happen. So I strongly encourage you, senators, to please send a message of hope and unity for the families that have endured this and for the families that are facing this now. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Sorry.
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Raji Beck. Raji Beck? No, not here? Okay. George Nakata?
Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Ferrioli, members of the Rules Committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to appear before you today. Greatly appreciated. I say that because it's an honor to be
Can
with you,
put you
again.
Can you put your name on the record, please? Can you put your name on the record?
George Nakata.
Thank you.
I say that because this is my second opportunity to appear before this distinguished Rules Committee. I think it was the last legislative session that I appeared before you on the Minoru Yasui case, which of course related to Executive Order 9066. I compliment your committee for looking into this very historic sufferings of the Japanese people. Senate concurrent resolution number 14, as I view it, is a symbol for acknowledging past injustices. I'd like to make some brief comments of how I was impacted by the incarceration. It was way back in 1941 December that I woke up as an American citizen. A few days later, I went to sleep as an enemy alien. The Oregonian called us the Yellow Peril, all because of Executive Order 9066, an executive order that brought along many exclusion orders. For example, the curfew that disallowed us to leave our homes after 8 o'clock p.m. until 6 o'clock the following morning. Our family suddenly had a number, our family number 15066. Suddenly, an evacuation order. Yes, we lost everything. Home, my father lost three businesses, family heirlooms. I remember my sister losing her whole set of Japanese festival dolls. Our family lost our dignity, and we lost our dreams. We were bused from Japantown in Northwest Portland to the Portland Assembly Center. Euphemism, really horse stalls, chicken coops, and pig pens. Upon entering that building, I shall never forget the pungent odor of the manure seeping through the wooden floors, the smell of livestock urine. We went into our 14 by 19 little plywood stalls to find four army cots and a canvas bag thereon, instructed to take those canvas bags into the center where they used to have horse stalls, put that straw into these canvas bags because that was to serve as your mattress. There were pigeons and black flies flying all over. I remember fly papers being hung, black flies sticking on them, black with flies all over the Portland Assembly Center. That was the summer of 1942, 6 months when 3,767 of us lived in that barbed wire barn. In the fall of 42, we were bused down to the Union Station. We were put aboard trains, marching down the aisles were the MPs, the military police, ordering us to pull the window shades down. We were not to see where we were going. We Japanese from Japantown, we didn't travel. Remember, this is 1941. It's not a mobile society. We never went east of Multnomah Falls, and yet the train rolled on all night long, and finally we're deboarding. We're getting off, and somebody says we're in a place called Idaho. It could have been Greece. They put us aboard another bus, 19 and a half miles northeast of Twin Falls, into a sea of sagebrush. This is Minidoka. Minidoka, one of 10 American concentration camps that housed 120,000 of us. It was indeed the largest stripping of freedom of any ethnic group since slavery. We lived in Block 34, Barrack Number 6, tar-papered barracks, no insulation. We lined up for everything. We lined up to eat, to take a shower, to do our laundry. I remember lining up once a week to get our two rolls of toilet paper. Block 34 had no water when we first arrived, against the Geneva Convention. It was my job as a young boy to go up to Block 36 with two pails of water, get water to bring back so my family could have something to brush their teeth with and drink some water. In the winter of 1942, records will show that I went 22 below zero. 22 below zero in a place that was non-insulated, which is tar paper and wood. My sister and I bundled ourselves with every piece of clothing. We huddled underneath this one blanket, waiting for the minutes, the hours, and finally for morning to arrive. There were eight guard towers. So for 3.5 years, we were prisoners of war. Franklin Delano Roosevelt himself called it an American concentration camp. He called us inmates. In 1943, the U.S. government, particularly the U.S. Army, allowed volunteers of Japanese American descent to join the Army. And we did. 20,000 of them from the 10 concentration camps and from Hawaii to form a segregated unit, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. They fought and fought brilliantly with heavy casualties in North Africa and Italy and France and Germany, the most highly decorated unit in the annals of American history. They saved the Lost Battalion from Texas. They liberated the town of Brière on the border of France and Germany. We all know of the Holocaust and the horrendous treatment of the Jewish people. The slave camps, the ovens, if you will. I went there in 1952. I visited, and I saw a little plaque in this area, and it said simply, "Here lies 1,000 Jews." Dachau was a series of camps. The largest subcamp was freed by a division of the 442nd. And when they blew off the lock and the doors opened, the Jewish people did not come streaming out. They couldn't. They were skin and bones. They barely crawled out. And when they crawled out, they saw the soldiers, and they looked kind of Asian, and they were surprised. But the Japanese American soldiers said, "Don't be surprised. We are Americans. We are part of the U.S. Army. You are now free." The war ends. We're given $25 and a ticket back to where we came from, back to Portland, where we had nothing. We had already given up everything in 1942. We became migrant workers, my parents and my sister and I. We picked berries, we picked beans for our very survival. We shopped at Goodwill. Yes, today I am very proud to donate to Goodwill, and I tell my grandchildren, this is where I shopped back in 45. A lot of stories that I can share with you. Let me just take a couple of moments to tell you about my parents, Mama and Papa. They came from the rice fields of Okayama to start a new life here in America. They are symbolic of the first generation Issei's. They were not permitted to be citizens of this great country of ours. They couldn't own property. But in 1952, the McCarran-Walter Act allowed them to be citizens. My father, because of age, was able to take his test in Japanese. My mother was younger. She could not. She had to take her test in English. She didn't speak English fluently. My sister Mary and I drilled her for 3 months about the three branches of government, about the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the House of Representatives, all the elements that she might be asked. She passed with flying colors. My father and I became citizens of this great country, along with 75 others. I remember going down to the Multnomah County Courthouse, where they raised their right hand and became citizens of this great country. There were no finer citizens. My mother and father, Mama and Papa, were symbolic of the Issei generation. They voted in every election thereafter. Mary and I went down there and told them about every candidate, every measure, every initiative. They missed, never missed, an election or a vote. They displayed the flag, American flag, proudly on each holiday. Redress came in 1988. 43 years too late. 50,000 of the 120,000 had already died, including my mother and father. That's how it was. I always ask myself the question, why did they single out Japanese? There was no trial. There was no due process. And during the war, there was not one single incident of espionage. They singled us out for one simple reason only. For that, who we are. That was the only reason. Dark chapter in American history. And as we sit here and consider and deliberate on the House bill, the resolution, concurrent number 14, acknowledging the constitutional errors of Executive Order 9066. I, as just one single person who spent 4 years behind barbed wires, I say to you that in America, freedom is very fragile. Let us not ever be so careless with our Constitution. And maybe I can be one vote of 120,000 of us that were incarcerated. It would be my great hope that this Rules Committee would strongly support this particular resolution with a resounding yes. Chair Burdick, thank you for your time.
And thank you for your story. Okay. Lynn Longfellow.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and committee members. I just want to say thank you for giving us this time to testify. My name is Lynn Fujigami Longfellow, and I'm the Executive Director for Oregon Nikki Endowment, and we are a nonprofit that has a Japanese American History Museum and the Japanese American Historical Plaza, also known as the Bill of Rights Memorial, and where we share and preserve the history of the Japanese Americans in the Pacific Northwest. We educate the public about their experience during World War II. And of course, because of this, we advocate for the protection of civil rights for all. I'm also here as a board member of the Portland JCL and the Japanese Ancestral Society. And both the JCL and Oregon Nikkei Endowment have provided or submitted written testimony. But I'm here today really to share on a more personal level and why this resolution is so important to my generation. And I apologize if I resort to reading once in a while, because this is, as you know, a very emotional subject. Hopefully many of you will remember really the moving testimony of George Nakata and Lily Irinaga last year for Minyasui Day. And nothing is more powerful than their stories and those that were that experienced this unjust incarceration firsthand. But as someone from the following generations, or Sansei as our generation is known, I wanted to share my own family's history in hopes that you'll see the multi-generational impact that the incarceration has had. So my family was incarcerated in Machi, Granada, Colorado. And my grandfather was 60 when he entered camp, and my grandmother was 54. They lost their 20-acre farm and beautiful home that they owned, where they had spent most of their life and raised their family. They should have been able, been allowed to live out their life and retire comfortably. And instead, because of Executive Order 9066, they were given 5 days to sell what they could and pack up and take with them only what they could carry. In camp, while working as a foreman to help turn the desolate farmland surrounding the camp into fertile, desolate land surrounding the camp to turn it into fertile farmland, my grandfather and several other workers were thrown from a truck in an accident. He fractured his back and was permanently injured, and shortly thereafter, my grandmother suffered a stroke. And this is due in part to the stress and because of the heartbreak. And they never really recovered physically. When the war ended, of course, they were given $25 and told to, you know, here you go, start your new life. My father and 9 uncles served in the segregated units of the 100th Infantry Battalion, the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and the Military Intelligence Service that were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. And to this day, they are the most decorated unit in military history for their size and length of service. And these men served and fought and died for the very country that was holding their families in prison behind barbed wire. And they did this to prove that they were loyal and worthy Americans. But just to be worthy, they knew that they had to be exceptional and extraordinary. And this, I think, carried over to the Sensei post-war. We grew up with that you have to be better. You have to try harder just to be equal. You have to be perfect to be equal. And I never thought I was anything but American. But I remember kids calling me a Jap. And I recall the sting when kids would pull out the sides of their eyes and yell at me, "Mommy, Mommy, my pigtails are too tight." And I remember being called a liar when I stood up in my seventh grade class to tell the story of what happened to my family during World War II. And luckily, I had a teacher that stood up and verified that I was telling the truth. And this history was not taught in the classroom, it was not in the textbooks, and that's very often the case today. And as long as I can remember, and even today, I have people comment and say, "It is such a shame that you don't speak Japanese. You never learned the language. You know, it was not passed on to you." And they don't understand that, beginning with our grandparents, they told our parents to speak English, and because of the fear and shame that came along with incarceration, they had to disassociate with being Japanese or anything Japanese. Family history and heirlooms were destroyed. People never talked about the past, and there was a huge disconnect between generations. We grew up not wanting to be different and to assimilate. What a tragedy that so much rich culture and heritage was lost through shame, and heartbreaking, really. And it's why I do the work that I do today, and actually what inspired my father to become chief counsel for the Attorney General's office here in the state of Oregon. We have a short memory, and in 1982, a congressional commission condemned the incarceration, declaring that it was not justified by military necessity, but it instead was based on race prejudice, war hysteria, and a fear failure of political leadership. And yet today our country's principles of democracy are once again being threatened in the name of national security. And we must not forget that we are a nation and a country that was founded by immigrants that came here because there were no walls. Diversity is what makes our nation so unique, and it's what makes our country great. America cannot be the land of opportunity for just some. You have before you Senate Resolution 14 that summarizes the significance and the importance of why it should be supported, and raising awareness and education is really the key to fighting fear and prejudice. Acknowledging the 75th anniversary of Japanese American internment and recognizing National Day of Remembrance is not just about remembering and reflection. As the resolution states, we must remember the lessons and blessings of liberty and justice for all. But more important, this comes with a responsibility to defend it and never forget the lessons that we learned from history, both good and bad. The Japanese Americans did not let this dark chapter define them. And we as a country must not be defined by fear and its darkest instincts. We must be ready to defend the rights, liberties, freedom, and ideals that are the foundation of our country. I was here last year when Senators Thompson and Representative Klein and Representative Johnson introduced the Minoru Yasui Day bill that passed unanimously in the House and the Senate. And I remember walking into Senator Ferrioli's office when I was lobbying, and Kimberly McCulloch from the ACLU said, "This is really an important meeting." And Senator Ferrioli walked in and proceeded to school us on why the bill needed to be passed. So we're really proud of Oregon's leaders that continue to stand tall. There is no failure of political leadership here, as there was back in 1942. And we feel that supporting the Resolution 14 will continue to show that Oregon is a state that stands up for liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, we'll take our next three as a panel, Barbara Bellis, June Schumann, and Jim Azzamano.
Hello. Chair Burdick, members of the Senate Rules Committee, my name is Barbara Bellis. It is an honor to speak today in support of Senate Concurrent Resolution 14 in solidarity with the voices of living survivors of these grave injustices of 75 years ago. I speak today as one who has had the gift of 30 years of connection with the Asui family of Hood River, as a pastor, friend, and ally, through the difficult and exhilarating process of redress, and as historian of the legal case and the activist leadership of Minoru Yasui. I first met Mr. Yasui in the summer of 1986. New to my parish, I was presiding at a Yasui family funeral, and I came to know his story. A few months later, Min passed away at the age of 70. I didn't realize how young that was at the time, and clearly, I would never be the same. I learned at a cellular level what happened to the family, to the Japanese-American community, and what a key, courageous, and proactive figure Min Yasui was. I stepped out of parish ministry to research and write a dissertation at University of Oregon about his legal challenge, the Coram Nobis case, and the redress leadership. I experienced historically and personally how deeply our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor are tied together in this commonwealth of conviction. What threatens one of us threatens all of us. Our democracy relies at the most basic human level on our care and concern for our common good. As Martin Luther King said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Our bold national experiment in independence, human rights, and self-government in a constitutional democracy with limited powers of government, three separate branches, checks and balances, is at a time of severe testing. It requires constant vigilance to sustain. I can only hope and trust that at this moment in our history, we will be sobered by recalling these mistakes of 75 years ago, heartened by the success of redress in 1988 with the Civil Liberties Act, and with great effort and powerful testimony and research by the Commission on the Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians, the bipartisan commission concluding that the incarceration was not out of military necessity, but by longstanding racial prejudice, wartime hysteria, failure of political leadership. There is no one who more wanted this story to be told and learned from than the favorite son of Oregon, the only person in this state to ever win the Presidential Medal of Freedom, Minoru Yasui. The very last thing that Min said to me at the end of a lengthy conversation at his aunt's funeral dinner as he was exiting was, "Pastor, I simply will not believe that justice will not be done." He gave himself a great, unforgettable exit line. Just a few months after that, he passed. He died in mid-stride. He never let up. He never gave up. Earlier that same day, the first thing that he'd said to me, we stood at the Idlewild Cemetery at his aunt's grave, and Min looked at me and said, "Pastor, when my time comes, I want to be buried here." And then he said, "You can see the mountain from here, and even when you cannot see it, you know that it's there." In tribute to his vision, "You can see the mountain from here," I wrote the dissertation entitled it that, and I'm working on a book which extols something that comes from the text on the Presidential Medal of Freedom, that we remember the power of one voice echoing for justice. I thank you for this opportunity to speak from my life and my heart in support of this resolution and our common responsibility to be vigilant in the defense of liberty for all. Minoru said as he realized back in 1986 that he might not live to see redress, which he fought for so long and so hard and passed just 2 years after his death. He said, "I have sat in the shade of trees that I did not plant. So it behooves me to plant trees in whose shade I will never sit." He and others planted trees of a renewed awareness of constitutional protections, not only for redress for one community, but to say never again, not to anyone. In his memory, in honor of internees and veterans, in service of a nation worthy of his sacrifice, let us sit in and let us protect that shade of equal rights, like the cedar trees in the heights of Hood River where Min has gone home. And his stone reads, "Justice for all." Thank you.
Chair Burdick and members of the Rule Committee, my name is June Arima Schumann. I reside at 3025 Northeast 34th Avenue in Portland. I'm here in support of SCR 14 being considered by the Senate to acknowledge the 75th anniversary of Japanese American internment during World War II and to recognize National Day of Remembrance. I'm here as a private citizen. My views are influenced by my years of community involvement in leadership roles, including founding executive director of Oregon Nikkei Legacy Center, a Japanese American History Museum in Portland, past board co-chair of Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, and most recently as project coordinator for the Minoru Yasui Tribute Project, which successfully nominated Mr. Yasui for the 2015 Presidential Medal of Freedom. I want to thank the committee and the Oregon legislature for the unanimous vote in 2016 to establish March 28 as Minoru Yasui Day in perpetuity. I applaud this effort by the state legislature to publicly acknowledge the one of the most shameful events in American history and for all Oregonians to be made aware of and understand what took place then. The signing of Executive Order 9066 is about what American government did to its own citizens and its legal residents without due process, I must say. It was racial profiling in mass scale. While we understand the fear that gripped the country at that time, we should never use fear as the excuse for scapegoating and taking away civil liberties guaranteed to all of us. Thank you for your leadership in moving forward on SCR 14, and by doing so, acknowledging those who suffered the indignities, economic loss, and deprivations of the denial of basic civil liberties that we should all expect and enjoy. Most importantly, I hope that this resolution will inspire all Oregonians to see the relevant connections between the events of 75 years ago and the current political environment that is creating jeopardy to the civil liberties of new groups of immigrants and refugees. Most Oregonians have immigrant pasts, and we should do everything we can to prevent anything like Executive Order 9066 from happening again. We should all speak up and stand up for rights of all. One of the ways the Nikkei community is working to get more people to speak out, because when Executive Order 9066 was signed,
very few people spoke up in support of Japanese and Japanese Americans. There was a deafening silence across this country. So we should change that. We should know more now and be better prepared. And so we have created a campaign to get the word out that something like an executive order should never happen again. And so the campaign is called Never Again PDX. And this poster is available in the website called neveragainpdx.org, and it can be downloaded. It will be really great for all senators to have a copy in your office and all the representatives to have a copy in their offices. So I hope that might be a possibility. Thank you for this opportunity to address your committee.
Thank you. Mr. Asimono.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Vice Chair Ferrioli, thanks for giving us this opportunity to speak to you today about this important measure, SCR 14. I'm Jim Asimono. I now reside in Tolovana Park, Oregon. As I've heard the stories today, it reminded me that question of why this hasn't been discussed and taught in schools. And just to give you a little vignette on my personal experience in college, I was doing pretty good in American history, which was unlike me, and I was getting A's and B's in history, and then we were getting to that period of time around World War II. And I asked the instructor if she wanted to know what really happened around the Portland area in 1942 to 45. And from that time on, I got D's and F's and had a very difficult time passing that without going back and negotiating a pass. But that's one of the reasons why the education part is skipped. I'm here in support today for the measure, and I'm a board member of the Friends of Minidoka, an Idaho nonprofit, which provides advice and assistance to the Minidoka National Historic Site, the concentration camp in Idaho, in which my family and most Oregon Japanese Americans and their families were incarcerated in World War II. I'm born and raised in Oregon, now residing over in Tolovana Park. Last Thursday was National Bagel Day. So in preparation for this day, I was amazed how that tiny little bagel could be recognized nationwide. The daily bagel means so much to so many. So then, why should we remember the Japanese-American experience? Well, in particular, in support of a National Day of Remembrance. Well, people are beginning to see the 1942 presidential order in its perspective and history, and that 120,000 legal Japanese Americans and resident aliens and Alaskan Aleuts were picked up by federal agencies and taken by train, bus, and fishing boats to wartime internment camps to dampen the fear from people who resembled the enemy. And as you know, we also can't forget the 442nd Battalion, Infantry Battalion of Japanese Americans from Hawaii and the mainland who fought in a segregated infantry unit in Europe, which included one action that you may have already heard of, in which they suffered over 800 casualties to save 211 Texans of the 141st Division. Well, we Oregonians must specifically remember that before segregating the military in 1948, and before desegregating the schools in 1954, and before Rosa Parks kept her seat on that bus, before Martin Luther King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech in 1963, before President Johnson's landmark Civil Rights Act of 64, the Civil Rights Act of 88 and 91, Oregon had its own champion in the evolution of civil liberties, Minoru Yasui, as you've heard about. A National Day of Remembrance will remind our families that I'm the son and grandson of families number 16234 and 16187, who lost homes, businesses, personal properties, and their American dignity in the evacuation to detention
to the fragrant stockyards, as you've heard descriptions of in Portland, and eventual detention at Minidoka. Perhaps most of all, a National Day of Remembrance will help fulfill the vision of President Ford when he terminated President Roosevelt's Executive Order 9066 with Proclamation 4417 in 1976. His words in the proclamation were, "I call upon the American people to affirm with me this American promise, that we have learned from the tragedy of that long ago experience forever to treasure liberty and justice for each individual American, and resolve that this kind of action shall never be repeated." Well, at a time in America when civil liberties are again in the political arena for debate and review, it is incumbent on the great state of Oregon to take its place in the evolution of liberty and justice for all and move this measure forward in support of a National Day of Remembrance. The stories that you've heard today and will continue to hear, the principles and values of democracy and our civil liberties, are worth a lot more than a bagel. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our last panel will be Carol Suzuki and Jim Stembridge.
You've been invited to the Never Again video by Holly Yasui, and I hope you'll all attend.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Carol Suzuki, and it's an honor to testify in favor of SCR 14. I'm a third-generation Oregonian and Japanese-American whose family was directly impacted by Executive Order 9066. My grandparents immigrated to Oregon in the early 1900s from Japan, and they were recruited from Japan to work as immigrant farm laborers along the West Coast. They eventually settled in the Hood River Valley, where they had two children, my dad, Hideo, and his sister, Kiku, and were able to lease land and farm it, growing asparagus, strawberries, and other produce, and eventually tree fruits like apples and pears. It's important to note my family still has an orchard in the Hood River Valley. But as immigrants from Japan, my grandparents were not allowed to own land, and as noted by a previous speaker, Japanese immigrants were not allowed to do that until 1952. So what happened in my family is when my father and aunt became old enough, my family was able to own land in their name as U.S. citizens. And so that's how they came to lease land and have something of their own. So the passage of SCR 14 is important to me because my grandparents, after living in the United States for over 25 years as law-abiding citizens, or alien residents as they were called, were wrongly incarcerated in camps run by the U.S. government during World War II. And this included my father, aunt, and other family members who were American-born U.S. citizens. And they were not in prison because they had broken any laws and not because they had been involved with any subversive activities or crimes, but simply based on the fact that they looked like the enemy, and also based on the idea that while they hadn't committed any crimes or acts of sabotage or espionage, they might. And that very idea of that is chilling, and yet it seems that some people in positions of power still seem to be of that same mindset. I believe it is important that we commemorate the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066 because the lingering memory of this betrayal still affects me today. I think about my dad being 19 and a recent high school grad with his whole life ahead of him, and then within a matter of weeks being imprisoned by his own country. It is important to me because my uncle enlisted in the United States Army from behind barbed wire and was a member of the 442nd. And it's important to me because Executive Order 9066 still casts a shadow over me and my family today. I, too, experienced many instances of racial prejudice growing up in Hood River that I will not go into today, but I wanted to share a story of something that happened very recently, and it nearly broke my heart when my daughter, after hearing references to the Muslim ban in the news and knowing what happened to people of Japanese ancestry during World War II, asked me if they would come for her. And then she asked me if she looked American enough, like her own blonde hair, blue-eyed dad, so that she wouldn't be under suspicion. I did my best to assure her that she was safe and to always have pride in her racial heritage. I think sometimes the words of an innocent child are the ones that affect you the most. My daughter should certainly never be afraid of her own government. I work in the Capitol, her father is a state representative, and yet those thoughts remain. I believe very firmly that we as a society must stay vigilant and fight for the principles on which our democracy was founded, and that unless we remember and remind future generations of the past, we are in danger of repeating the mistakes of the past. This is why I feel so strongly about commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Japanese internment in honoring a national day of remembrance, and I urge you to pass SCR 14.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Jim. Thank you for having me, Madam Chair. Hello, members. Nice to see you again. I just want to add three things. Jim Stembridge from Salem, Oregon. First of all, I wanted to call your attention to a website. I have this on a sheet that there might be a few available, and we've had them submitted to the committee for adding to the records also. The website is Dorothea Lange's photographs that were taken. She was hired by the federal government to take photographs of the roundup and internment of the Japanese during World War II. And those photographs were suppressed, and the reason was because there was too much pathos in those photographs. She captured a lot of the drama that these families went through, and they're posted now on the internet in this at this site. I made a copy of a few pages for you to look at. Some of the pictures, some of the photographs are just wonderful pictures. They capture the moment. Not as well as some of the testimony you got today, but pretty well. The second thing I wanted to mention was the Endo decision, which led to the end of the internment, and that was a unanimous decision by the Supreme Court in December of 1944. One of the justices, Justice Murray, concurring, stated, "Racial discrimination of this nature bears no reasonable relation to military necessity and is utterly foreign to the ideals and traditions of the American people." I mentioned this as part of the Endo decision because last week when the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled on the recent Executive Order 13769, issued January 17th of this year, the Circuit Court cited the Endo decision as an example of previous federal court review of the constitutionality of executive action pertaining to national security. That's on page 17 of the decision, and I also have a cite on that if you wanted to see that. Thank you again for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, and thank you all for very, very compelling testimony. Okay, we will close the public hearing on SCR 14 and open a work session on SCR 14. Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I make a motion on SCR 14, if you don't mind, I have a couple of comments I'd like to make. For the record, the first is to recognize Jim Azumano, who was the executive director of the Oregon Office of Rural Policy. The Oregon Office of Rural Policy was designed to help try to combat what we considered in rural Oregon and still consider to be a disequity between urban and rural citizens based on their economic status, education, and opportunity, which even today is unfavorable when you compare it with urban Oregonia. So there is a disparity that we wish we had an Office of Rural Policy to address, since those issues have not been addressed. I also want to point out that Oregon has a very mixed history in terms of issues of equality. If you read the Territorial Charter from 1849, which was drafted by men and women who came to this territory or this area at the point in time that they did, and survived largely due to the generosity and the welcoming openness of the Native American tribes. They wrote a charter that is remarkable because it conveys full civil rights to the children of mixed race couples, Indian and French and British and Yankee. And the idea was that the folks that framed the territorial documents were in fact trying to create an opportunity for their children to inherit the property that they had accumulated. In 1859, the folks that wrote the state constitution reversed virtually all of those rights. And we went into a period of hostility between the newcomers to Oregon, the Yankees and the Westerners and the Western folks, our pioneers. And that resulted in Indian Wars and reservations and a whole bunch of other stuff that, if you look back through the prism of what we know now, were and are concentration camps. In the 1920s, we had the largest assembly of Ku Klux Klan marchers in the western states, more than 35,000 members in Oregon, in 60 chapters. Every community had a KKK or multiple KKK chapters. In 1923, we passed legislation that was directly supported by KKK. It was a new exclusionary law that prohibited Chinese and Japanese from owning property in Oregon. And that was well into the 20th century, 1923. In 1954, we saw the civil rights movement begin, and I'm proud to say a lot of it started right here in Oregon with legislation that guaranteed equality of public accommodation. 1960s, we saw tribal restorations. It seems to me that every generation faces its own challenges with these issues, and that we need to make sure we have a full understanding of the scope of history and realize that while we march forward, there's an occasional step backwards. The thing that I think is clear from the Minnesota saga is that he never failed in his absolute conviction in the Constitution and the foundational documents of freedom in this country, and his life's work was to assert it, and to make sure that people understood that when you stand on those foundational documents, you can move mountains, and he did so. So I just am very happy to support SCR 14, and Madam Chair, I move it forward with a do adopt recommendation, and I commend it to the committee's wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Senator Farioli has moved SCR 14 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Farioli, if you and Senator Manas Anderson would like to co-carry, that would be
It'll be an honor, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. And thank you, everyone who appeared today to testify. Your testimony was compelling.
Now let's talk about that Office of Rural Policy again.
We are adjourned.
Whoops.